Once the danger of civil war abated, Jackson could again turn his attention to prosecuting his war against the Bank of the United States, which he did with gusto. In 1833, Jackson had told Van Buren, "We have the bank now checkmated, and will treat her gently if she behaves." Behaving, however, was the furthest thing from Biddle's mind. During the nullification crisis, Biddle asked Daniel Webster to try to reason with the president over the deposits, apparently believing that as long as he could keep the bank in business, a second opportunity for recharter might present itself. Biddle's efforts came to naught, however. Even if Jackson had had no deep-seated aversion to banks or questions about the bank's constitutionality, he considered Biddle's actions during the recent election as a personal insult that demanded a response. As the events leading up to the recharter fight make clear, Jackson had a tendency to personalize political struggles, thereby ensuring that he would not be satisfied merely defeating the bank. He had to kill it. However, there were also practical reasons to do so. Writing to Jackson at the end of February 1833, James Hamilton advised the president that the bank still had the means to cause the administration trouble. Hamilton feared that Biddle would curtail lending or manipulate the currency exchange rates in order to induce a strong feeling in favor of a recharter of the bank as the only means of restoring a sound currency. Francis Blair, editor of the Globe and a respected member of Jackson's kitchen cabinet, was blunter. He advised the president that the damned bank ought to be put down, and the only way to do that was to take from it the whole of the public money. Unfortunately for the president, most of his cabinet, including Treasury Secretary McLean, opposed this policy. Under the bank's charter, only the Treasury Secretary could remove the federal government's deposits from the bank, so Jackson needed McLean's assent, but the president was destined for disappointment. McLean opposed removing the deposits before the bank's charter expired in March 1836, and given the federal government's experiences during the mid-1810s, the idea of placing the Treasury's money in state banks made him uneasy. On May 20, McLean wrote a letter to Jackson outlining his concerns and refusing to remove the deposits. Jackson should not have been surprised by McLean's defiance. After all, according to Taney, from the beginning, it was well understood that McLean was in favor of a renewal of the bank's charter, and this opinion was known to the president before he appointed McLean to the Treasury Department. That Jackson would knowingly appoint to his cabinet someone who disagreed with him on such a seemingly important issue may strike readers as foolhardy, and therefore unlikely, but it points to the fact that the Democrats at this point were not a political party in the sense of having a defined agenda or a coherent set of policy goals that united them. At the 1832 Democratic National Nominating Convention, the party had not adopted a platform. It had only nominated Jackson and Van Buren for president and vice president. Aside from patronage, it was fidelity to Jackson rather than any core set of beliefs or policies that held the party together. And as a result, people who identified themselves as members of the democracy held a broad range of views on issues.